go back to Kaysan, and I'll just go through a couple of these questions. And you alone, I think, of all the people I've interviewed, are remembering to incorporate part of the question in your statement. So most people don't, and that doesn't, it's not the end of the world, but excellent job. Okay, I'll ask you a few questions now relating specifically to Kaysan. In your book, and in what we talked with you this morning about, you mentioned that you had recognized, at least by the early fall of 1967, that a very serious North Vietnamese offensive was planned around Kaysan. And you say that you gave a good deal of continuing information on this subject to Johnson. I wonder if you would say how you identified Kaysan as an important battle and what kinds of things you did to make sure Johnson was aware of what was going to happen there.
The Kaysan, the focusing of the White House on Kaysan, came about in as best I remember it, in a sequence about like this, that in the autumn of 67, it became apparent from the flow of intelligence that something big was being generated. There were some battles on the frontiers of Cambodia and South Vietnam that had a very tough cutting edge to them. And the reporting was coming in that something big was building. And it had built enough so that by early December I was sure that there was going to be a big offensive. And on my own initiative, sent a request to Saigon asking for their evaluation. And the evaluation was the possibility of negotiations after it was set back. And we got that in and came in about the 8th of December. I turned it over to the intelligence community and I set up a package. Now, somewhere along in there, I don't know whether it's the end of November or in December, but sometime along there, two divisions were spotted in very reliable intelligence moving down from North Vietnam. And I do not recall what it was that triggered, in my mind, the notion that they may be under orders to set up an equivalent Dien Bien Phu at Kaysan. In any case, as part of the general flow of intelligence, I informed President Johnson of this possibility, and we monitored Kaysan perhaps more closely than the other part of town. Now, you have to understand, by way of background, that ever since the Bay of Pigs, when Mac Bundy was picked up from the Executive Office Building and put in the big west basement of the White House, sitting astride the floor of intelligence, the man holding that job was under instructions, which I never forgot, from President Kennedy, to stay on top of the floor of intelligence. And when I took over the job, I think I widened the flow of intelligence into the White House and established close collegial ties with some of the main sources, and had an extraordinarily able fellow running the situation named McCartney. And he and I worked very well, and we followed this thing, and it was fascinating to watch because you began to see a repetition of the pattern of the Dien Bien Phu in their movements. And that obviously was of interest to the president because he knew the political repercussions of Dien Bien Phu, knowing him as a senator at the time and having indeed been called on for a judgment after Dien Bien Phu by President Eisenhower to whether we should move forces in to help the French or to help rescue them at Dien Bien Phu. Now, so we kept him informed. And I don't know whether it was McCartney or me or who suggested we build this little model. It made it, the flow of intelligence was so detailed that without a model of the terrain, it was a little hard to understand just where they were positioning themselves and when they began to dig trenches. And it was just a minor enterprise. We weren't obsessed with it, but we followed it. And we were very conscious that Dien Bien Phu was a very different affair than this, because we had three advantages the French didn't have. We had about a 20-to-1 advantage over the French. and the weight of bombing we could bring against the North Vietnamese. We had an 8-to-1 advantage in terms of our ability to supply with aircraft. We had a whole lot of divisions in reserve that we could have brought in to rescue them, which the French didn't have. And we had a terrain feature that was extremely important, which the press never caught, which was that Dien Bien Phu was in the bottom of a valley. Khe Sanh was on a plateau with mountains covering it, but we were in those mountains, not the enemy, so that we were shooting down on them, they weren't shooting down on us. And altogether, we were interested in this exercise, which was an exercise in trying to use air power plus a small force on the spot to pin down a very much larger North Vietnamese force. The figures of the North Vietnamese pinned down were at least 20,000, and we had about 6,000. And what we wanted to do was to pin them down so they didn't have to get into the cities. Now, their objective was, if possible, to reproduce Dien Bien Phu, but at the minimum, to put our forces under such pressure that we were forced to withdraw forces from the cities, including Hue and Da Nang, to save them, and that would open up Hue and Da Nang for attack by other Vietnamese. And as it came out, we, with relatively low casualties, pinned them down, decimated them. And it was one of the few cases in a war of this kind where the Allied forces were vastly inferior to the pinned down a much larger force than the enemy.
This morning, when you talked about this, you used a couple of phrases that fascinated me, and I'd like to get them on film. One, you quoted the statement of Marx about Napoleon III, and I'd like you to mention that again. And also, you talked about Giap and his zigzag trenches. And if you could, in some graceful way, include those two things, it would be useful. Mention that Giap was in command at Dien Bien Phu and at Khe Sanh.
There is a, as you watch the unfolding of the whole episode of Khe Sanh, it occurred to me at the time, not merely in retrospect, that what you were seeing was a homo of Karl Marx's carried out. In the famous essay on Napoleon III, he said, history never repeats itself except
the
farce.
I can't go back and watch this again.
And as you watch General Giap, who had been the commanding general in Dien Bien Phu, it was one of his glories, moving in on Khe Sanh, you had the feeling that here was a man trapped by his memories. Almost, if you knew the story of Dien Bien Phu, almost every kind of move and tactic was repeated, including the attempt to get at the U.S. forces by building a series of zigzag trenches so that ultimately they would just pour into our base, if they ever got there. And there was the same mixture of a military operation, which if it came off, it was designed to produce a tremendous and definitive political trauma. Now, as far as the political trauma is concerned, indeed, the Tet Offensive as a whole did produce a considerable trauma. But there was no Dien Bien Phu case on, and in fact, I don't know what his arithmetic was, whether he really knew what it would be like to be under 20 times the weight of bombs that he faced at Dien Bien Phu, or 8 times the weight of supply forces, or if he fully taken into account the terrain features, including the emplacement of our artillery men in the hills, which made his men the targets for us.
One of the things that Peter and I think of when making a film is the kinds of stories or visual images that will make our audience interested in what's going on. And frankly, neither of us, as just average citizens, have a good sense of what the situation in the room in the White House looked like. And I wonder if you could describe what the Situation Room looked like at the time that the Khe Sanh model was in there.
We have 2 minutes left to take.
Okay.
The Situation Room in the White House and the council room next to it, where I had my staff meeting, was extremely austere. if you go back to the contemporary White House, it's been elevated under the Nixon administration to sort of White House modern and really looks a lot more fancy and impressive than it did in our time. I tried to, remembering the Bay of Pigs, to keep my offices very spare. I refused to have them redecorated. For example, I had threadbare rugs and poor furniture, and everybody else got redecorated because I remembered that it ought to be a spare newspaper man's office, you know, because we were supposed to keep on top of things and we shouldn't get softened up by over-impressive furniture. So it was just the room in which I had my morning meetings with my NSC staff, and it was over in the corner. On the rest of the wall, there were maps. You could roll down maps of any part of the world. There was a television set that we could use if we wanted to, and it was used in an engaging sequence at the time of the Middle East crisis of 67. We were drafting a hotline message to Kosygin, but we had it on, and you can see in the photographs Ambassador Goldberg's picture, because we were, well, drafting the message, we had a follow-up going on in the UN, and he was our ambassador up there. But it was, I think, several thousand officials in the U.S. government that had more impressive offices than we had down there in the Situation Room and our council room next year.
Was the model set up all the time, or just...
Yeah, we...
Okay. Oh, go ahead, we have a few seconds left.
Okay. The model, once we set it up, it was no big secret. We pushed it over the corner, and we wanted to look at it, update it. You see, the men in the Situation Room kept it updated, and you'd move the flags. We had every North Vietnamese unit and every one of our units flagged, and we moved them up and move around. And so that if the president ever wanted to see what it was like today, he could see what it was like today.
And would he come in to see it?
He came down at least once. And there's a photograph, I believe, of George Christian and President Johnson.
Seat number 3 won't rust out. Back up a little bit. That's great on the I love the piano stuff. Now, did somebody just record those things, or anybody?
He brought Gordon Craig down, and he gave a very learned speech on diplomacy on the eve of European diplomacy on the eve of the Second World War. And it was just quietly announced at the bottom that after the lecture, Professor Craig and Professor Rostow performed some of the songs they wrote at Oxford. This place was filled. It was right here. And actually, we taped in the morning a lot more of them, but in the afternoon, we did about 10 of them.
That's great.
And his voice is just as good as it ever was. And he's kept the value, taking them more seriously, because he wrote the lyrics and he's got a book of them. And it was just delightful. And he has one kind of romantic one that he sang, got some of the younger people weeping.
Oh, great.
How about that? Terrific.
David and I have a third friend. When we go to conferences, we find an opportunity to sing around the piano.
All right. Ready?
Ready? Okay. I want to go back on the subject of the terrain model that's right in front of us here. Do you think that Lyndon Johnson felt safer about Khe Sanh because he could visualize it through a model like this? Or did you yourself find that this was a good way to understand what was going on?
The model was built simply because the battle that was shaping up was obviously going to be confined to a limited area where the terrain features mattered. There's no point in putting pins on a map. Here were some 6,000 of our forces placed on a plateau and some overlooking hills and some scouts out. And the enemy was moving some 20,000 men up into very particular positions. And so simply to understand the meaning of this positioning and the course of the battle, we thought this rather modest terrain map, looking back on it, I think that's a That's not a very expensive operation, but it's quite accurate. It was done over at the Pentagon by men who do that sort of thing. And it did help us understand the reports we were getting. When a hill was mentioned, they had simply observation people. We knew where that was. And the batteries that were providing each other mutual protection, we could visualize that, and the airfield was a real thing to us.
One of the things that Peter and I are interested in is the fact that when you got your assignment, a national security advisor, you ended up offering so much advice about military tactics. How did that come about?
I was national security advisor, but I did not actually offer much military advice. My job, I was not Secretary of Defense. I was not commanding general of the field in Southeast Asia. I was not chairman of the Joint Chiefs. I did have a general view on the way the war was being fought, which I expressed to President Johnson, and on one occasion only, when we were discussing in about April of 67, I stood up and went to the map and laid out how I thought the war could be brought more quickly to a close. But I did not regard my position as that of a military advisor. I did feel a duty that the president be fully informed on the course of the battle, and I took steps from the first days I was in the job in April of 66 to make sure he got more full reporting and more understandable reporting. I found that the Pentagon reports came over to the president in the peculiar jargon of staff officers. And unless for your sins you lived that kind of a life, as I had in the Second World War for a while, it was, might have been written in Chinese. So I called up the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and said, "Do you have a Rhodes Scholar around there who can write English?" And this was the chairman, a great friend of mine, and I said, "This stuff's unreasonable, and I don't think the president's reading it. He's reading about the course of battle in other ways, but not nearly enough detail." So we then got good military reports out of the Pentagon, and I got a revision in the flow of stuff from the CIA and also from the State Department. And so I didn't take it that my job was military strategy.
We've heard a good bit from various people about President Johnson's tremendous concerns about Dien Bien Phu and whether in the world Khe San might end up this way. And Johnson took the unusual step of demanding a written guarantee from the Joint Chiefs that Khe San could be defended, which they offered at the end of January 1968. I wonder if you would comment about that circumstance, mentioning the existence of this letter, and what you thought about Johnson's concerns about the Joint Chiefs' response.
My memory of it is that President Johnson was not all that obsessed with Khe San. He was aware of the analogy and of the political danger if those troops were captured. He did inquire of the Joint Chiefs, and I believe General Taylor was brought in. He'd been a consultant on military matters to President Kennedy as well as President Johnson. And he did ask the opinion of the Joint Chiefs. And what I remember clearly is that after they said, "Yes, we think it can be defended," it wasn't a guarantee, a headquarters folks can't guarantee a situation in the field. He decided that he would just go with Westmoreland's judgment. And Westmoreland was absolutely at peace on this matter for just the reasons that a lot of us who'd studied the differences between Dien Bien Phu and Khe San were pretty peaceful about it. But I think it was simply, this was before Tet. We all felt it was part of this big thing that was blowing up, and of which President Johnson was aware. But he thought that that was a particular vulnerability, and he just feared the political consequences of that garrison being overrun. But I think, like President Kennedy, he had an extraordinarily personal sense of responsibility as Commander-in-Chief. And I think, thinking of that outpost over there, he didn't want those fellows up there to be overrun. I think it wasn't simply a broad commander's view at the political, military level, but he looked out there, he thought these mighty gallant fellows, and his Marines out there, and he wanted to make sure they were well looked after. But I don't remember his coming back to it. And the fact that we built this, and President Johnson was rather well informed about it, and came down at least once to look at it, should not give you the impression that he was obsessed with all this. He had an awful lot of different things he was dealing with at the same time, including many, many dimensions of Vietnam other than this.
On a second request related to this, know well about the request for 205 or 206,000 additional troops, which was made. And one of the things we'd just like you to say something about is whether it's your understanding that General Wheeler and the Joint Chiefs were trying to use Khe Sanh as a hook, phrases Chandler's, to get an additional call-up for military manpower when it perhaps was not all that necessary.
The question of the extra 200,000 men had nothing whatsoever to do with Khe Sanh. The question of the 200,000 men arose as the battle moved along and was, as I remember it, a kind of not merely insurance policy, but from the point of view of Westmoreland and the Joint Chiefs, a way of assuring that when the enemy was set back, we could follow through with maximum force. It's the same 200,000 that was debated in April 67, and where I had taken the position that if we got them, we should use them in a different way, and not just more of the same, but we were going to close off the trails in Laos and move as far north as Vin. But Khe Sanh, by the time that the issue of the 200,000 rose, my impression that we had a great sense of security about it. And indeed, when it came down to looking at the 200,000 seriously, the bottleneck turned out to be M16 rifles. In the wake of Tet, Hugh mobilized an additional, I think, 125,000. And as President Johnson said, if there's a shortage of M16 rifles, I'm sure that I want them allocated to the South Vietnamese who are prepared to fight, rather than Americans, additional Americans we'd send over. So that the 200,000 had been firmly turned down before the New York Times published that famous story.
A question relating to Johnson's visits to troops departing from Fort Bragg and from El Toro. Now this morning, Peter and I were looking at outtakes. So we know that you were on board the Constellation in February, which led us to assume you must have been at Fort Bragg and at El Toro. Johnson, in his memoirs, indicates that a very emotional moment occurred. I read it yesterday in a speech he gave March 1st to Jack Brooks in Beaumont. He told the same anecdote about the man whose baby had been born the night before. We saw this morning in those outtakes the face of Johnson, where he was clearly affected. Can you contribute anything about what you observed, or did Johnson say to you at that time that he had talked to a guy who had just had a son born the night before and was going back to Vietnam?
In 68, when President Johnson was sending over some additional men to Vietnam, airborne, he did go out and see them personally and see them off, and he was deeply affected. The story of the man who was leaving the day after his child was born is one that at the time and in retrospect he came back to as symbolizing really the sense of pain and responsibility and personal involvement that he undoubtedly felt for all of the men that were out there fighting under his direction as Commander-in-Chief. I did not see the higher reaches of World War II, although I was involved in it, or Korea. And it may well be that President Kennedy and President Johnson had a rather more intimate sense of responsibility for men in the field than most presidents. I don't think it's I say that quite objectively. I don't think that the president who looked at it more professionally would nevertheless automatically be less compassionate or wrong, but these two men did feel the intimacy of that connection, which I saw closely with President Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs, and I saw often with President Johnson. In some of the critics of the war never really understood what an extraordinarily personal and painful thing it is for a president to sign off on those letters to the families. Casualties come one by one to a president. And so that in sending men into battle or seeing casualties, the two presidents I worked with, in any case, were hated war deeply, personally, had every reason to. And it's unless you see the president sitting up and signing those things one by one, you don't quite capture what is involved in a human being bearing that responsibility.
I want to ask you one question. It's just about the last one, relating to public opinion. You talk about this in Diffusion of Power. There seems to be a good bit of difficulty in scholarly writings as to the actual impact of TEP on public opinion in the United States or on Johnson's popularity. There's this problem of the sense of rallying around the flag, which you talk of in Diffusion of Power. And could you say something about your attitude as to the actual impact of TEP on public opinion and whether Johnson felt that the polls were doing something specific during the TEP crisis of 68?
Public opinion was not my responsibility, although public opinion was obviously a substantial dimension of the war. In fact, I had in my office in the Planning Council of State and then the White House, and I have it in my office here, a Saturday Evening Post story of about 62, in which the premier of the government in Hanoi was interviewed by Bernard Faw. And he said, Americans don't like long, inconclusive wars. This will be long, inconclusive war, and we shall therefore win. In other words, the Hanoi was operating on this difficulty that the United States has, perhaps all democracies, but the United States, in sustaining a long, inclusive engagement, the way, for example, the British sustained the guerrilla war, in Malaya for 12 years. But be that as it may, what happened at TEP, as I recall and as I see it in the polls in retrospect, was that there was an enormous surge of support for very strong action. I think an immediate post-TEP poll had 61% of the people designating themselves as hawks. That figure had fallen to perhaps 54, 57, something like that by early January of 68. Then, as the president did not appear to take decisive action, he didn't mine Haiphong, he didn't start B-52 attacks around Hanoi Haiphong, he didn't organize forces for invading the North. But as the president, following his own plan of action, be it right or wrong, let the forces get defeated in the field and then move towards negotiations, what happened then was the beginning of a riptide. That riptide was partly the lack of the president by action galvanizing that hawk majority, and partly the misinterpretation of TEP by media. But in any case, the net result was a falling away of support for the war after TEP. The immediate response was very hawkish. I think any kind of action the president had chosen to take heat of the battle would have been strongly supported, especially if it looked as though it might be military decisive. But people not understanding what indeed had happened or what the outcome of the battle had been, and drawing the opinion, well, this is going to go on forever, and a mood of Winitor Goodout took over, and since the president didn't seem to be about to try to win it with decisive military action, you had a gradual erosion of support. Now, it didn't go to zero, it stabilized as some down to Mr. Nixon's time, but...